twisted view or wrong view, but a correct biblical view of who we are, O Lord, and therefore have a correct understanding of who you are. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Turn with me in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 11. I'm just curious, did everybody leave church today, or is there people downstairs? Okay, interesting. Okay. Genesis chapter 11. Verse 1. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words, and as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, so they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of the earth. And from there, the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. We already know this story, the traditional story of the Tower of Babel. And often we relate it to the explanation of the multiplicity of language, and linguistics, or the dispersion of the nations upon the face of the earth after the flood. And while this is all true, there is undergirding this passage a far more meaningful lesson, and it is the lesson of understanding how humanity copes, behaves, and thinks apart from God. Genesis, the book of Genesis, is all about God creating man in his image and the fall from grace and how that permeates through the rest of creation. And we see, obviously, God covenanting with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and setting apart a people for himself. And here we get a breakdown of how the nations are dispersed and how people basically wander from God. What's really focusing in here is on this humanistic identity with one another. We see people are one nation. They speak one language. And as the Lord speaks from him, he says, nothing they do, anything they put their mind to, they can accomplish. And what we see here in this building of this tower is a building of a monument of human greatness, a building of a monument to point to the achievement of humanity. And ever since the Tower of Babel, man has been building towers. And towers in general are symbols of man's greatness, symbols of man's power. And we've seen how quickly the Twin Towers went down in 9/11, and buildings crumble, towers crumble. And so it's a very feeble attempt at signifying human greatness. Well, why do I start with this? And I think I start with this is because we're introducing a new topic today, the topic of biblical anthropology or the study of man, the right study of the doctrine of man. When I say the word man, I'm talking about all humanity. Man is a generic term that represents both male and female. The Lord clearly speaks in that language in the Bible. Inferred in there is also a complementarian view of male headship, both in the home and in the church and in creation. Men certainly failed. Adam failed at that headship in the garden, which led to the human race's plunge, which is why Adam is always the one who bears the guilt, because he is the head. Even though Eve sinned first, it is Adam who bore the guilt as the head of the human race. And therefore, what we want to seek to do here today is get a right understanding of who we are as human beings and get a proper understanding of not only who we are, but what our purpose is. And this is, by the way, what the driving forces of all philosophy. All philosophers ask the question at the end of the day, what is man? What are we here for? What's our purpose? And isn't that really the question of life? Now, we must seek to answer this question biblically. Why? Because there are many competing ideas and ideologies that tell us who we are or who we should be that are muddying up the waters and muddying up our brains. And even among evangelical Christians, among church-going people, against spirit-filled Christians, we have been confused because we've been inundated with so many false views of humanity in our lifetime. If you've gone to college, more than likely you have been indoctrinated and taught things to give you a view of humanity that is completely contrary to what the Bible teaches. And what I'd like to do today, and one of the things we're going to do, is look at several of these views, these wrong views of humanity, to show us against what the right view of humanity is. Because the bottom line is, if we don't understand who we truly are as human beings, we're not going to have a proper understanding of God, we won't have a proper understanding of the gospel, and we won't have a proper understanding of our relationship to God. So it's absolutely critical that we do this. And so for today is just the intro. I'm just kind of teasing you a little bit. But over the next several weeks, we're going to be covering some great lessons and have a great lineup of guys teaching. You're going to hear some really good lessons. And I think we all stand to learn a lot here. All right, so one of the things I want to talk about is the rise of secular humanism. Now, humanism in its very core is nothing new. Genesis 11 is a perfect picture of secular humanism. It's a picture of humanity, worshiping humanity, celebrating humanity, and seeing as humanity is the center of existence. And throughout the Bible, that is most personified in all of the pagan kingdoms. Whether it's Egypt or Assyria or Babylon or Rome, what is the common denominator in all of these ancient kingdoms is that the king or the emperor, whoever the supreme leader is of these empires, claims to be God on earth. And it's always a celebration of man and of man's achievements. After the Christianization of the world in the third century of Europe, I should say, we see the Renaissance period in the 1300s reintroduce humanism, where people had enough of a Roman Catholic hegemony over Europe, where God was always at the front and center, and there began a going back to pagan roots into this celebration of man. And much of Renaissance art shows the might of man and the glory of man, like the statue of David or even Michelangelo's painting on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel is designed to point us to not only God, but man's finger touching God and man's masculinity and greatness and human achievement. And we see it now more than ever that humanism is making a comeback. I give two definitions there. One, secular. The word secular means not connected with religion or anything spiritual, right? So when we talk about something that's secular, it's an institution or an idea that's separated from anything religious. And we talk about humanism, the definition here is both from Oxford Dictionary, as an outlook or system or thought attaching prime importance to the human rather than to the divine or supernatural matters. Look at our society today, and whether it's in our politics, whether it's in our global foreign affairs, man is at the front and center of everything. One of the things which I've seen in the last two elections, both in a Democratic president and Republican president, is absolutely diehard, devoted, and committed people to their leader or the leader of their party, regardless or blind to anything that may be wrong with that leader. It is really a worship of man, a worship and an honoring and an exalting and a lifting up of a human far higher than he ought to be. And this is what happens when a nation turns its back on God. When a nation turns its back on God, man by nature is going to worship the next best thing, man. Our society today has become increasingly secular and increasingly humanistic. The secular humanistic view dominates our education system from kindergarten to college, particularly in the public education system. It dominates in our political sphere, and it dominates in Hollywood, it dominates in mass media, it dominates in absolutely every sphere of life that exists today. The question is, have we bought into it, and do we understand who we are properly as God's children? Now, as we get into this, and by the way, something that I see that I didn't mention here, is that when you get to the book of Revelation, the book of Revelation clearly shows us that the end result of all of this, the end result of all of this is the worship of the beast being the Antichrist. That is the culmination of humanism, the worship of man. And so with this said, I think it's important that we look at the fruits of secular humanism, because looking over the last 150 years, particularly since the 19th century, we've seen two world wars, we've seen racism, we've seen ethnic cleansing, eugenics, communism, alienation, and moral degradation as all parts or fruits of this move towards secular humanism. And so with that, today we're going to jump into this, and I'm going to give us an introduction, first of five reasons why we need to study the doctrine of man, then two, we're going to look at seven wrong views of man, and then three, finally, the biblical view of man. Does anybody have any questions or comments at this point? Stephen?
What's eugenics?
Eugenics, very good question. Anyone else here familiar with the term eugenics and know what it is? Well, you asked the question. You can't answer it. You're asked. All right. I'm. Go ahead. You know the answer, Anne-Marie?
No, I don't.
Does anyone else know? Go ahead, Tom. Very good. So eugenics was a theory that was in vogue in the early 20th century among elitists and intelligentsia and academics and universities. A lot of what we're going to be talking about, you see, one of the problems why we have a wrong view of humanity, it really goes down to one person in particular, Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin, in his book that he wrote in the 19th century regarding the theory of macroevolution, that man is not a product of creation of God, but we evolved from primordial slime through billions of years of random selection and processes. This began a bedrock into terms of a whole new bed of philosophies, and it affected everything. Often you've heard me refer to, and I don't claim this originally, but Al Mohler talks about the four horsemen of the intellectual apocalypse. And that consists of Charles Darwin, that consists of Karl Marx, that consists of Sigmund Freud, and it consists of Friedrich Nietzsche. Those are some of the four big philosophers of the late 19th century that have influenced and developed secular humanism to where it is today. But Charles Darwin is the father of it all. You couldn't have modern psychology, you couldn't have a Nietzscheistic, nihilistic view of life, and you couldn't have a Marxist theory of humanity apart from the idea that man is not created in God's image. It's the granddaddy of them all. So an offshoot of this is called social Darwinism, and it's how we got Nazism in the early 20th century. Because in the whole Darwinistic view, one of the underlining platforms or presuppositions within that theory is that there's a battle, or should I say, oh my goodness, my mind is just drawing a blank today. What is the term I'm looking for? Survival of the fittest. You've heard that term, survival of the fittest, that's rooted in Darwinistic theory. And that's the idea of random selection. How does one species mutate and evolve over another species? It's because of the idea of survival of the fittest. The stronger species is going to evolve and dominate over the weaker species, and the weaker species will eventually become extinct. Now, this was transposed into a very socialistic view of life and called social Darwinism. And this is the natural fruits. This is where you go if you believe in this kind of stuff. And in the early 20th century, the idea was, well, let's look at the human race. There are stronger elements of the human race and weaker elements of the human race. And so many of European white-skinned people felt that they were superior, and this is where we have racism, this is where we have ethnic superiority, felt that those who were inferior to them or weaker needed to be exterminated. And not necessarily had to do with skin color. Eugenics was a system that sought to eliminate the weaker species as these intelligentsias would see it and academics would see it. It could be those who are mentally inferior. So back in the early 20th century, if you had a mental disease, you would be castrated, or women would have their tubes tied so that they couldn't bear children. They were sterilized. This was part of a eugenics program. Planned Parenthood and the founder, Margaret Sanger, was a proponent of eugenics and believed that abortion would be used to cleanse and rid the world of unwanted parts of society or weaker parts of society. And so that's eugenics. And this is what happens when you have a false view of humanity. When you have a wrong view of humanity and a wrong view of who a human being is created in God's image, you wind up with all kinds of garbage. So that kind of explains eugenics, Stephen. He walked out. He got tired of listening to me. All of these things are a result of secular humanism. And today, you know, these same things are still reasoned and debated, and we have a lot of work to do as Christians in understanding our worldview. All right, five reasons why we should study the doctrine of man. Number one, this doctrine is important in relationship to other Christian doctrines. All right, every doctrine in and of itself is important, right? I say the doctrine of God is important, right? Now I'm on the doctrine of man. Well, this is very important. So what's more important than the other? They're all important because they all complement one another and they all support one another. A wrong understanding of God will give us a wrong understanding of man and vice versa. But the understanding of the doctrine of man helps and supports and gives a better understanding of a relationship to other doctrines. For instance, one of the early church doctrines that the church struggled with was of a dualistic view of the universe. This was imported from Greek philosophy that material or matter in the universe is intrinsically evil, and that which is spiritual is intrinsically good. And so there was this understanding, particularly in the first century church, of Gnosticism and cults that arose that had a wrong view and understanding of who we were as man. And so the understanding was that, you know, we're luminescent beings and you know, as they would say in Star Wars, not this crude matter, right? And so the idea was that our physical beings, our flesh was evil, and we would not truly understand what it is to be saved until we're liberated from these wretched human bodies and to go to heaven. Well, how is that a bad thing? It's a bad thing because it had a direct implication on people's understanding of the deity of Christ. This became a heresy known as Docetism, which denied the humanity of Jesus. In some cases, in these Gnostic heresies, they said, no, it's impossible for God to take on human flesh because flesh and matter in and of itself is evil. And so therefore, Christ was a spiritual being. We only saw him as physical or material, but he really was spiritual. And it really wasn't Jesus who died on the cross because you can't kill the Son of God. It was Judas. Judas was transposed or transferred to the cross instead of Jesus, and you think you saw Jesus die, but it was really Judas who died. It's ludicrous. But this is what happens when you have a wrong view of humanity. And so it affects our view of the incarnation. Jesus is very, very man, and he's very, very God. He's 100% human and 100% deity. You can't separate the two. It's our understanding of soteriology. Because if Jesus became a man, why did he become a man? He became a man so that he may become our representative, the head of the human race, to redeem us and save us. All these doctrines of Christology, of soteriology, of creation, all are rooted in a proper understanding of the doctrine of man. Secondly, a right understanding of the doctrine of man opens up the door for us to present the Bible to unbelievers as God's revelation. While people may not care much about God or talking about God, there's one thing people do care about is themselves. And the Bible has more to say about the human essence and the human experience than any other book in the world. Right? In some ways, the Bible, you know, is used by a lot of people as a self-help book. And it very well could have that essence where the Bible addresses most of our human needs and most of our human ideas. And so, you know, we have that opportunity. You have a lost friend or family member, and they're in a crisis. Someone died, and they're mourning, or they're depressed, or they're going through something. You have always a chance to refer to the Bible and use it as God's revelation to introduce them to the Bible, and ultimately to introduce them to God. Thirdly, it is important to note that our view of who man is will also determine our ethics. Now, this is critical, because one of the things we see in our society today is there's so many ethical conundrums we're faced with. Human cloning. Is it ethical? If it is or isn't, why? If you have a view that man is created in the image of God and man is a creature, then there's something unethical about it. But if we evolved, and we evolved from primordial slime, then what is unethical about it if we're just a result of random chance and selection? Ethics play a big part into this. Euthanasia, abortion. All of these are questions. Even now we're faced with a whole question of whether same-sex marriage is legitimate or not. It was the guy who's being questioned for FBI. Do you know who was Mike Pompeo? What is his role? What was he in Senate hearings for this week? Does somebody know? Secretary of State. Yeah. One of the senators, I can't remember his name, Cory Booker, grilled him. He says, "Do you believe it's a sin for homosexuals to marry?" As if it was something bad to believe that. But that's exactly what the world has come to. If you believe that same-sex marriage is a sin, there's something wrong with you. There's something evil. There's something perverted with you. You're the pervert. You're the twisted one. Well, where does it stem from? A wrong view of humanity. If we're just evolving as human beings and we're just a result of random selection, what does it matter if you're homosexual or not? But if God created us in his image, both male and female, and the first marriage that was instituted by God was not a homosexual but a heterosexual marriage, then God has a lot to say about this. It affects our ethic on this. All of these ethical issues we're faced with today, and particularly we'll speak about a little later, in gender identity. Who's to say that my biology indicates who I really am? I'll determine who I am. I don't care what my DNA or my body looks like. If I feel I want to be a different gender, or maybe I want to be both genders, I can be whatever I want to be. Actually, there was a recently I heard that, I think it was one of those social media platforms, is about 20 different options that you can identify with. And one, you can just identify as nothing. I'm nothing. But our identity is intrinsically bound up in what God says. And if God didn't say it, and there's no relationship to divine revelation in our humanity, then we have all these crises at hand. And you could see this all unfolding. And it all boils down to pushing aside a biblical worldview, a Christian worldview, embracing this secular, humanistic worldview, and once you do that, anything goes. Of course. Well, Satan was behind the fall, and what was behind the fall was to defy God's authority, to take authority for ourselves so that we write the rules. That it is. Absolutely, because it's all falls short of the glory of God. Number four, it helps us to have a clearer explanation and understanding of human identity. And this is picking up where we last left off, you know. People want to know who they are, right? And so much is bound up in identity because we talk about this, right? Who are we, you know, as people? You know, the concept of racism in and of itself, where we hear often there's multiple races, and yet there's the Bible calls us one human race. If anything, there's only two races, and I'll preach on it next week. There's the race of Adam and the race of Christ. We're all one. There's just one human race. Yeah, we have different complexions and different facial features, and we might have different cultures, but we're still human. We're all made in the image of God. The concepts of racism are developed and designed from a human secularist point of view, not from a biblical point of view. The New Testament speaks and condemns so harshly the racism in its own day of Jews and Gentiles. There was hatred and animosity between the two groups. And it was affecting the early church. But Christ died to end that division, to bring everybody together. You know, we don't talk about just... And so, you know, often people today will identify themselves based on their community or their race or their ethnicity or their culture. And in this case, you know, we talk about our sexuality. You know, we've included this new thing, like we talk about freedom for all Americans, freedom for everybody, no matter what nationality, ethnicity, and now you have to add to that sexual choice. Well, since when does sexual choice, how does that identify you? Well, what it's become now is an identifier. You're identified not someone who so much practices these things, but I am, people say, a homosexual, or I am a heterosexual. We identify ourselves by our behavior. Right? If someone is a liar, do they say, I am a liar, and I am an adulterer, I am an adulterer, or I'm an angry person, I have a right to be an angry person and be respected and with all races. We've taken behaviors and created them to be identifiers of who we are as people. The gender identity crisis is a whole other issue too. And it all goes back to a denial and a rejection of what God teaches in divine revelation. And the fifth reason why we want to study this doctrine is so that we will have a better understanding of humanity. The better understanding of humanity you have, the more effective we will communicate with and reach the lost. We're all called to preach the gospel and to win unbelievers to us, right? The better understanding we have of who human beings are and what our essence is, the more compassion, the more love, and the more we'll be able to identify and realize at the end of the day that we are part of the human race too. It's not an us versus them mentality. God saved me, called me, cleansed me. But man, I have a lot in common with everyone else in this world, and but for the grace of God, there go I. And so we don't judge and we don't condemn and look down on others who are confused and messed up and because they're in darkness. They're in spiritual darkness. But we're not. We've been enlightened. And so the more we study the doctrine of man, the more it's going to help us in relating to other people and to minister the gospel. Well, let me stop at this point and ask, are there any questions or comments? All right. No words that I said that confused anyone? Steve, any big words? All right. You sure? What do you guys think about what I'm saying in these five reasons? Is there anything you could relate to that may have helped you, Anne-Marie?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting, but you can see how much Hollywood also drives these agendas. Mm-hmm. And people follow blindly, not even questioning, is it wrong or is it right? They just want to fit in. They want to be accepted. And so, okay, this year is the year. questioning. Mm-hmm. And it's like you see the deadness in people as they just, you know, it's...
Sheeple. Bible refers to us like sheep, right? We're all like sheep. We all go astray. And what do sheep do? Sheep follow other sheep. Sheep will follow another sheep right off a cliff. Well, and this is exactly what happens when we lose a biblical worldview on reality. Go ahead, brother.
I found out what you said about the simple truth that we're created in God's invisible power and how that relates to ethics.
Yes.
I think if you don't, you know, view people as precious, made in God's image, then you know you wouldn't care for the sick, the elderly, those who are babies in the womb.
Precisely.
They go, you know, protect the lives of the unborn. I think it all begins. So theology matters, basically.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom. Stephen.
Going back to apologetics, we have a better worldview. People decry racism, but secular humanism and science is what drives racism. People don't realize that the current argument is that there's multiple different human races populating out of Ethiopia or something. The biblical worldview.
Absolutely. Secular humanism drives people apart. I think, you know, it's because it's rooted in, it's man-centered again. All right, Marva, one more. Right.
Versus we know man is a sinner, a dirty, rotten sinner.
Yes.
So I don't know if that belongs in...
No, this is just the introduction, but we have a whole lesson. We have a few lessons dedicated to the effect of sin, the result of sin, the magnitude of sin, or origin of sin. We'll definitely be covering that, Marva, in great depth. Because, yes, it absolutely is imperative we understand how sin has tainted humanity. But you know, this is just a primer today. Each week we're going to be building upon this, and at the end I'll kind of give you a breakdown of the subjects to come for the next few weeks. All right, moving on. All right, so what are the competing views of man in today? What are the competing views of humanity? I'm laying down this foundation that all the views we're going to look at now are built upon the foundation of Darwinism. All of these views are built on secular humanism, and they're all different offshoots of how people view humanity based on this idea that human beings are just the result of billions of years of random selection and macroevolution, that we do not have a reference point or an origin, and that we're not created in the image of the divine. And so based on this, you have a lot of consequences. There are consequences to ideas, and here are the consequences, how it affects humanity. First view we're going to look at is that man is a machine or a tool. This is often referred to as utilitarianism or pragmatism. That man is simply a machine or a tool. In this view, man's value or human's value is determined. We value people based not on who they are, but on what they could do, what their skills are, how productive they are, and what their capabilities are. You brought up a good point there, Tom. When you think about, different societies, particularly Nazism, before the Nazis went after the Jews, the T1 program was introduced. It was their test ground to see if they can get away with the Jewish Holocaust. And what the Nazis did was they went into hospitals and they got all the sick and those who were not productive and those who couldn't do anything for society. They went to mental hospitals and got those who were mentally ill, and they rounded them up and killed them all. Because after all, they can't do nothing. They're incapable. They're leeching off the system. So let's just get rid of them. And so that's the ultimate end, where you have this idea where man is simply a tool or utilitarian view. In fact, I've argued before, and I solely believe that even abortion is rooted in a utilitarian view. Those who support abortion, I think at the end of the day, are not so concerned about a woman's rights as they are concerned about controlling society, controlling population, and because it costs money when you have population growths in certain areas and people are looking to control society, and it's all rooted in a racist. It's all rooted in a very utilitarian, man is a tool type of mentality. Go ahead, brother. A one-child law in China. A very good example. China is a perfect example. China is an atheist state, and they govern with the one-child policy to control the population. Very good. In this view, we treat people as tools to be used. You see, when someone's a tool, how do you treat them? You use them. What do you do with tools? You use them. Instead of valuing people based on who they are as human beings. What are some examples of this that we might see in society? We looked at those two, but how could it even affect the church? How could it affect us as Christians? Anybody? Are there ever times where Christians may look at people like tools? Stephen? Very good point. They're not useful.
It seems like it's more of it's too much to care for this person, so we're just going to try to ignore that.
I've been in conversations with people in like denominational leadership where families or members of church are called giving units, right? Instead of people or persons, we see them as giving units. How much are they value based on how much they give? That could be not just monetarily, but to the church. And so we evaluate people based on what their productivity is. Pastor Paul?
I think that's brought out in 2 Timothy chapter 4, mm-hmm. verses 2 to 4, where it speaks about people come to the point where they don't want sound doctrine anymore, so they get somebody that will tickle their ears, and so they're being used as tools to give the people what they want.
Correct. That's a good way of looking at it, too. Thank you. Anyone else? We see this in many aspects of society. You know, the Bible says you can't love God and money, right? You know what happens when you love money? You know what happens when money becomes your God? You use people to get money, right? You use people to get money. But when you love God, you use money to help people. See, what happens is when you love money, you see people as tools to help you get more. But when you love God, you love people, you use money as a tool to help people. Money is a tool. People are made in God's image. We use money to help people, not to use people to get money. All right. Another false view. So we have the utilitarian view. Man is a machine or tool. Another view is that man is an animal, right? Well, let's think about it. In a theory of evolution, that's all we really are, right? In fact, if you take a biology course in college, we're considered mammals, right? Human beings are considered mammals. And evolution will be shown, say, look, we got two arms and two legs just like bears and horses and dogs, and so we're animals just like them. And you know, they have this view of that early humanity, which we have no provable link or no provable fossils, that, you know, we were these ape-like people who were hunched over, and so we eventually evolved and got to become human beings. And so if that's the case, then we are animals, aren't we? And if we're animals, then how do we evaluate and understand animals? Well, we understand animals by their behavior, and their behavior is dictated by their instincts. And so if all we are is animals, we're simply creatures of instinct. The disciplines of psychology and sociology, where people try to understand human behavior, always liken it to animals. For example, I've read recently, I was reading in an article, I can't remember what publication, where one psychologist was writing about how monogamy is not part of our DNA. The whole argument here was that monogamy is a result of religion forced on people, that we by nature are animals. And the whole argument of the article was like, if you look at animals, they're not monogamous. Animals are promiscuous. Animals, you know, will continue relations with many different animals because it's their nature. And so with this theory in mind, this woman was arguing, a psychologist, that monogamy really isn't who we are as animals. We evolved based on our nature as evolved animals. We should shun monogamy and be polyamorous. Do you see where the line of thinking goes? But even in a more judgmental way, I was talking to the principal of my children's old school they used to go to for the younger years, in Stephanie's school, where Hudson View Baptist, and met Pastor Mark Benedict, great guy. He was telling us a story where they went on a class trip one time, and there was a lot of kids there who were just out of control, and the security guard came up to them and said, "Listen, we apologize. These kids are a bunch of animals." And Mark Benedict said to them, he says, "Animals? That's not what they are. Those are human beings created in the image of God." He corrected the guy. And you see, that's how we think. We refer to people as animals, and people are not animals. We are all created in the image of God. We're human beings. All right, next. The next wrong view. Man is an erotic being. Man is an erotic being. This is Freudism. Sigmund Freud was the pioneer of modern psychology. And Freud had a warped view of humanity, again, based on a Darwinistic view. And he believed that we were tripartite beings, that the id was the inner core of a human being, which was just a cauldron of burning sexual desires. The ego was the human expression of the id, the personality that we see on the outside. And the superego was the ability to control or restrain the id. And Freudism saw all human behavior, one way or the other, as an expression of human libido seeking gratification. And so in Freud's understanding of human psychology, all neuroses and all psychological problems are rooted in the fact that human beings are repressed sexually. And that if we cast off restraints and cast off the social constructs of guilt and simply indulge in our wildest fantasies, that we'll have true peace, inner peace, and true understanding of self. How do we see that? How do we see how that theory or that view of man has percolated society today? Yeah. Right? That started, what, in the 1960s? I wish Bob Gross was here. Bob was a hippie from the 60s. Showed me the pictures, really funny. But yeah, that's where it all started, but it even started before that, right? I mean, you know. It's been around for a long time, but this philosophy, Freudism, has particularly affected our society, and look at where we are today. I mean, guys, look around you. We are the most over-sexualized society. I mean, well, any Western country is, but it is just crazy. I mean, look what, you can't watch TV, you can't do anything today without some kind of innuendo or double entendre that refers to some kind of sexuality. You know, I was walking with my daughters in Ridge Hill Mall the other day, and we walked by the Victoria's Secret store. What's that, Daddy? You know, there's a sense where there's nothing sacred no more. There's no such thing as shame. There's no such thing as decency. And if you believe in any of those things, you're seen as uptight, or you're seen as a square, or some, you know, hillbilly hick who hasn't been truly educated. It's just a shame. This is what happens when you have a wrong view of man. Next wrong view is man as an economic being. Man is an economic being, and this is where we get the basis of Marxism. In a Marxist worldview, Karl Marx, also one of the Enlightenment period philosophers who had a great impact on society today, influenced the society, defined man as simply an economic being. What drives man? What motivates man? It's economic forces. Food, clothing, meaningful employment. That's what identifies and shapes all human behavior. And so a Marxist worldview sees that the reason why there's crime and the reason why there's war and the reason why there's problems is because people don't have enough to eat. And so in a Marxist worldview, we need to take the resources from the rich, make sure everybody gets an even share. And if you've studied Marxism, understand Marxism, the goal is a utopian society. The Marxist truly believes that in an equal distribution of wealth, there will be no more crime, there'll be no more hurt or war or violence, that there'll be a peace, a utopian society where there's just unfettered peace and enjoyment of the human race. Does anybody really believe that? Well, Lenin and Stalin, who ran with it, it didn't work too well for 60 million people who died. Mao Zedong, it didn't work out too good for the people in China. And yet,
the assumption probably is that they assume that man is ultimately good and therefore willing and will work well under this system.
Man is simply an economic being. That's all we are. You're either the bourgeoisie or the proletariat. And if you're the proletariat, your reason for your problems is that the bourgeoisie has all the wealth and you don't. And so what does that create? It creates social class war, right? The rich versus the poor. If only we had what the rich had, we would be fine, but we were not happy because we don't have it. You know, people don't realize that man is desperately wicked in his heart. And even when man is full and has all the food in the world, he'll still act wicked. In fact, if we know anything about human societies, the more money people have, the more wicked they are. So man is an economic being, and this is certainly a view. How is this infiltrated into our society today? What expression of this do we see? How do we see how this has influenced and shaped society today? Go ahead, Emery.
I think what the revolution of technology, we're constantly, we're able to work almost 24 hours a day.
I mean, that would be more of a materialistic, and we could often talk about a communal view of man. You know, this idea of trying to find meaning in relationships with other people through social media. Go ahead. Alienation. Beautiful, right? Was it the Stop Wall Street, or what was it called? Where all the people were defecating all over the street and leaving it for the city to clean up, right? I mean, what was it called? I forgot the name of it. But it died out pretty quickly. When I went to college, I think every one of my professors and nearly all the students were Marxists. And I used to debate all the time in class. Large portion of society today is Marxist. Large portion of society. Go ahead.
In surveys stated, over 50% of young people today prefer what you're just talking about, a society just like you're talking about.
Well, 20, I mean, the percentage of atheists for young people today is significantly high. Like 80% of young people in their early 20s are atheists. It's the highest it's ever been in our country. And so when you have a godless worldview, all of these views come into play. It actually forms a toxic recipe and cocktail of all these views. And what's going to happen is going to be ugly in the future. I could tell you that. We've seen the history of it in the 20th. All right. Next, man is a pawn in the universe. Fatalism. In this view, man is simply seen as a helpless entity in this big, hostile universe that's indifferent to us, and we're nothing more than a speck of dust in the cosmos. You ever feel like that sometimes? You're just a meaningless speck. Bertrand Russell, the atheist who had this worldview, he just saw life as meaningless, and the universe is just this big, massive, chaotic entity with its own will, and we're just victims of the force of the universe. There's many people who have this view of man. F, man is an autonomous being, libertinism. There's some people that identify man or see the essence of man ultimately bound up in freedom. That freedom is the ultimate expression of human essence. A man's identity and dignity is bound up in his freedom to choose his destiny. This plays in our own political system, Western democracies, going back to the political theory of John Locke. A libertarian philosophy has this view too, in that, you know, ultimately what defines us as humans is our freedom to choose. How does this affect theologically? Right? People who have a libertine view of humanity and see us ultimately as free agents and autonomous beings are going to struggle with a view of God's sovereignty, aren't they? Because if the highest understanding of humanity is our freedom and ability to choose, well, that doesn't really work too well with a biblical worldview that says our ability to choose is limited to some degree by God. And finally, man is a social being. Man sees his essence bound up in his relationship with other communities and people and how he functions within that group. And see, what all these things, all these different views show us is that if you have this worldview, it's going to affect your ethic, it's going to affect the way you behave, and most important, it's going to affect the way you look at other people. Now we look at a Christian worldview, and then we're going to close. I'm going to go through this very simply. Man, here's the Christian view of humanity, very simple. Man is a created person, and we were created to glorify God and enjoy him forever. There's two things we have to understand. Number one is that we're creatures. We are creatures. We were created. God created the first man and the first woman, Adam and Eve. And from Adam and Eve have come the whole human race. And even in our mother's womb, when the biologic components come together, an egg and a sperm to fertilize, and there is a miracle of God, a work of creation must take place for us to come to life. We're created beings. And because we're creatures means that we're subject to the Creator. It means that we're the property of the Creator, and it means we are dependent on the Creator, and it means we owe our existence to the Creator. And that does not sit well with many people. Because the idea that we're created means that we're not sovereign. It means that God is sovereign. It means that I'm not truly autonomous. It means that only God is truly autonomous. And it means that I don't have the right to do whatever I want. God has the right to tell me what to do. Absolutely. That is built into our DNA. And scientists, evolutionary scientists, can't explain the God gene, they call it. You see, if you really want to, You know what really throws a monkey wrench into the whole theory of evolution? The theory of evolution teaches the survival of the fittest, right? But according to the science community, religious people are weak. So if religious people are weak, how did we come to be on the top of the chain of the human race, right? It wasn't the survival of the fittest. It was Christians who were slaughtered and beheaded and their blood was spilled, and yet Christianity is the biggest religion in the world. It's not because of some defective gene. It's because God put that in us. He put eternity in our hearts, as Pastor Paul said. Secondly, we are persons. To be a person means to be able to make decisions, to set goals, to achieve those goals. It means we have freedom, a limited freedom, but freedom nonetheless. We're not merely pawns or robots in the universe. You see, we have to look at people not simply as units, not simply as census data, not simply as workers or capital holders, not simply as sexual beings, not simply as part of a community, not simply as tools, but people are persons. And we're each individually our own person. Personhood is something very real. It means we're emotional beings. We're spiritual beings. We're intellectual beings. And this is all the imprint of divinity on us. How do we balance out the creature who is dependent on God and the person who has his freedom? It's a dichotomy of which we'll never understand truly till we get to heaven. Anthony Hockema says this: in sum, the human being is both a creature and a person. He is a created person, and this is a central mystery. How can man be both a creature and a person at the same time? To be a creature means absolute dependence on God, and to be a person means relative independence. To be a creature means I cannot move a finger or utter a word apart from God, and to be a person means when my fingers move, I move them. And when words are uttered from my lips, I say them. To be a creature means God is the potter and I am the clay. To be a person means we are the ones who fashion our lives by our decisions. See, we maintain both because the Bible teaches both. On one hand, the Bible tells us that God is sovereign and nothing can happen apart from his hand. But yet we're told in the Bible that our decisions have real consequences. And so we embrace the two, and it's not so much a paradox, and as we'll get later down the road when we talk about human freedom, we look at the idea of compatibilism, how both God's will and man's will are compatible with each other. Let me close by saying this. To understand humanity from a biblical point of view, we must maintain these teachings, and we must be committed to understanding who we are in light of God's revelation. For the next several weeks, we'll be looking at the origin of man, man-made in God's image, the integrity or the constitution of man, the fall of man, the nature of sin, the result of sin, and the extent of sin. And that'll be it until the summer and we'll break. And so I encourage you all to get plugged in. We got some good lessons up ahead, some good guys teaching, and encourage others who aren't here today that they could also be part of Sunday school. Are there any questions or comments before we close? Jasmine?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of confusion out there. That's why we need to study hard at this. This is a good topic. I'm telling you, you'll come out of this a lot more prepared to dealing with these. Because there are questions. I mean, if you're honest with ourselves, we question these things ourselves, right? I mean, this is stuff that scholars study and still trying to figure out. These are deep topics. Anyone else? Anyone want to, anything, anybody want to share anything? All right. Go ahead, Tony. Yes.
Where is it covered?
The origin of sin will be original sin, how it all started in the garden. And the nature of sin will look at what sin is, explaining how it expresses itself in our lives. You know, it's funny because this is all coinciding, too, with my teaching. And I'm going next week into this, the origin of sin and the two human races, you know, in Romans 5, 12 through 21. Understanding who we are and has to go back to Adam and Eve. In fact, we'll be referring to Adam and Eve probably in every Bible study for the next few weeks. And see, it's critical that we even have a right understanding of Adam and Eve. There are evangelical scholars today who deny that Adam was a real being. If Adam was not a real being and it was just it's just a poem, then the whole gospel falls apart. Our whole understanding of humanity falls apart. It's critical that I would almost say it's orthodox and necessary that we believe that Adam was a real being and he was the first human being that God created in his image. He wasn't necessarily a man who evolved and then God put his spirit in one day and said, you're a human being. No, Adam was the first human being created from the dust of the ground and God breathed his spirit into his nostrils. You don't believe that, everything else caves in. The whole gospel message caves in under that. Anyone else? All right, let's pray. Father God in heaven, I want to thank you and praise you for this day. Lord, bless this teaching to our hearts and help us to be better equipped and thirsty and hungry to learn more about our identity in you. In Jesus' name, amen.